The Lock-In Podcast is brought to you by Rotocloud, the all-in-one solution for managing hospitality teams. Rotocloud lets you plan and share rotas, record attendance, and manage your team's annual leave, all in less time than it takes to make a brew. It also makes life easier for your staff, allowing them to check their rotas, request annual leave, and even pick up extra shifts, all through the Rotocloud mobile app. Start your 30-day free trial today by visiting rotocloud.com/lockin.
Hello and welcome to the William Reid Food and Drink Podcast. I'm journalist and podcast presenter Nicholas Robinson with a special show looking at the impact coronavirus has had across the food and drink sector. This podcast has been recorded in accordance with the coronavirus social distancing and lockdown rules, which means it has all been recorded over the phone and is therefore reflected in the sound quality. Now, from the field right down to the fork, in this podcast we'll be seeking to understand the impact the measures taken to protect lives against the virus have had on the food and drink supply chain. We'll be looking at everything from growing to manufacturing, retail, and how the hospitality sector is playing its part in feeding the nation too. To help us do this, several expert editors from business-to-business publisher William Reid have come together to tell us what is going on within the sectors and give their thoughts on the current state of the UK's food and drink supply chain. Let's start things at the beginning with editor of Food Manufacture magazine, Rod Addy. Rod, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Nick.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about the struggles faced by the supermarkets, pubs, bars and restaurants, but there's little mention in the likes of the national press about the growers and manufacturers. Why do you think this is?
Primarily, I think, because most of the time they do their job very well, and consequently, people take the sector for granted. And so they don't tend to focus on it. They don't think about it a lot. I think also the sector has perhaps, particularly in processing, a little bit of a bad image because people think about kind of manufacturing plants. They're not exactly the most glamorous locations. And they're quite content to kind of not think about how food gets in their plate. They're quite happy to just take for granted the fact that it does.
That's quite interesting. Now, at the very beginning of the process, how are the farmers and ingredients producers faring up in all of this?
Let's take the farmers first of all, and you can break that down into three categories. You've got fresh produce, you've got livestock, and within livestock you've got dairy and you've got meat. So if you look at fresh produce, first of all, the real challenge, and we'll see more of that later on, is finding labour to pick the fresh produce. So it's anything from salad to fruit to a lot of the kind of basic vegetables that we would take for granted. The challenge around labour is one that started well before coronavirus had an impact. Partly it was sparked by the situation with regard to Brexit. A lot of people that work on that side of things are people that come from, say, Eastern Europe and countries like that. And those people, for whatever reason, have kind of interpreted Brexit as not kind of favourable for promoting an environment of working within the UK. So the latest data suggests that they have kind of looked further afield. They've gone back to perhaps their home countries as well. And so you're seeing a kind of general shortage in labour as far as that's concerned anyway. Now you've got a situation which is compounded by COVID-19, where you've got the additional problems of people being sick, people having to self-isolate, which potentially reduces that workforce even further. So what's really happening? Well, we've heard about people flying workers in from Poland and initiatives as far as that's concerned. We've also heard about the initiative with regard to the land army within the UK to kind of find UK domestic workers who can pick up the slack and go into the fields and pick vegetables. And again, we'll hear more about that later on. So that's what's happening in fresh produce. And there's some signs that the positive progress is being made. On dairy and meat, the situation is a little bit different because the supply chain takes a little bit of a slower time to get off the ground, mainly because you can't grow a pig or a bull in the time it takes to kind of grow vegetables and things like that. That is a longer time scale, and so the supply chain tends to be a little bit slower anyway. Yeah. And there The problem you're seeing is that it's been hit very hard by the loss of food service. So all the restaurants that closed down, all the cafes that closed down, those outlets stocked particularly premium meat and also a lot of dairy, particularly milk, for example, if you look at cafes. So all of that business has dropped away. And consequently, you're looking at a situation where on the dairy side, a lot of dairy farmers are being forced into a position to dispose meat, dispose dairy and milk on farm even, because they're producing stuff that is not going to be used and is not going to be sold. And they also face the financial impact of that. And then for meat, you're seeing a carcass balance issue. So you're seeing a lot of cuts of meat, premium cuts, that would have gone into the restaurant sector, now not having a home because consumers don't seem to kind of want to buy those things because they come on higher price points. So consumers are going for a lot of cheaper cuts of meat. So the supply chain has to address that issue.
What is the supply chain doing to address it then? Will it come out of this in a good position, or could it mean the end for a fair few suppliers?
Oh, undoubtedly so, I think. Undoubtedly, there will be suppliers that were struggling initially that will go under, I think, as a result of this. I mean, the impact is absolutely massive, and both beef and dairy sectors are uniting to call on government support. And I think at some level, there does need to be government support. Of course, government is financing a lot of other issues as well. So, I mean, how much money can the government put forward? At the moment, it's been reasonably generous with its packages. But a lot more support is needed for both those sectors. And I think even though the money is there in theory, it entails actually kind of getting to the businesses. And that will entail how individual local governments manage that process. Some manage it quite well. Some, the flow is quite slow. And so if money doesn't get to these businesses in time, they will go under. What you're going to see is probably a lot of consolidation. You're probably going to see a lot more dairy cooperatives that exist with a lot of individual farmers as part of their membership, taking on board the smaller farmers, because the smaller farmers will not be able to survive otherwise.
Yeah, and the dairy industry has been struggling for a long time anyway, hasn't it, with undervalued milk?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So obviously there've been ongoing issues surrounding milk pricing and how that kind of is passed back down the chain to farmers, and farmers are kind of really, you know, they're making wafer thin margins really on what they're producing a lot of the time. So again, that's a situation that was the case even before coronavirus kind of really set, and now it's really been compounded, and the dairy industry, for example, is painting that as, you know, a catastrophe effectively in waiting, a pending catastrophe. So the survival of domestic UK dairy supply requires support and requires help, I think.
Yeah, and looking at the situation overall in terms of the manufacturers that are still working, still able to get their ingredients in, are they working as normal? Because there was a shortage in shops. Was that just down to panic buying, or was it up to suppliers not being able to keep up with the demand?
Well, I think it's kind of both, really. On the one hand, you saw a lot of panic buying with people. They were responding initially as soon as, because of course this thing kind of snowballs. So as soon as you go into a store and you recognise that some products aren't there and aren't available, then, you know, that word is passed around. Then people buy a lot more of that product and kind of stock it up. So, you know, inevitably a lot of store cupboard products were stocked up. And of course, that had a massive positive impact initially on sales for some kind of product areas. So one interesting trend you saw was around home baking. So lots of people snapped up kind of home baking stuff and started, you know, producing, you know, their own bread, their own cakes, things like that, a lot more things that they could kind of have for that purpose. But people were stocking up on things. So everybody will have seen shortages of things like pasta, dried goods, shortages of rice. And again, that was all panic buying and stockpiling. Now, obviously, because of that huge upsurge in demand, manufacturers found it very, very difficult to be able to respond quickly to that, because the demand, I mean, there are various figures being bandied around, but the uplift in demand was at least double what you would see in a lot of categories, even at Christmas. And with Christmas, you've got to obviously bear in mind that people plan for it, they build up for it for months in advance, whereas this just, you know, it was almost instantaneous. So inevitably there were shortages. Now you're seeing a situation where things are beginning to kind of level out and return to some sort of normality. Part of that has been helped by retailers imposing restrictions in terms of shopping hours, in terms of how many people could go into shops at one time. And things like that. So it's just given them a chance to restock, and equally it's pushed further down the line. It's given people, you know, a chance to produce the goods that are needed to then go into stores and then go into stocks.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen things like bread stocked up in supermarkets pretty well. Pasta, there's still a shortage. Tinned tomatoes, there's been warnings that countries aren't able to keep up with the demand to export to the UK.
Yes.
But obviously, manufacturers are now kind of having a bit of time to backfill those orders. What other strains is the sector still facing, though, that we're not aware of immediately?
So if you lift the lid, there are a few different things that are going on. So one of the things at the moment is a situation in factories, particularly larger factories. So a lot of big meat plants, for example, are facing problems around personal protective equipment and the lack of availability of that. And also around the inability to manage social distancing well, because obviously there are government requirements to the effect that, you know, if you're in a work environment, you should be at least kind of 2 meters apart from each other. Well, if you go into a big manufacturing plant, that's really, really difficult to achieve. Fortunately, if you look at the latest government guidance, it does say try to adhere to these rules as much as possible. But there is a recognition that, you know, in some instances, there will be challenges. And I think particularly that's true of the processing sector. And then personal protective equipment, that's things like masks. There's been some debate on the effectiveness of masks in terms of preventing infection of people around you, or indeed preventing you getting infected by coronavirus. But I think the point here is that whether or not it's effective and what the science is on that is kind of less important as the morale in terms of people working on the production line. Because if people think masks are important, if they think they're going to be an effective way of stopping them getting the virus, then if they don't have them, it's still going to impact on morale quite a lot. And again, if social distancing isn't being imposed rigorously, then that's going to be another big factor. So you're seeing an impact on morale. You've seen unions with members in processing plants making big issues out of that. And of course, you know, there's two sides to that. They have a point, but at the same time, unions are acting politically and they have an interest in increasing their membership. So, you know, it is the ideal time, if you like, for them to do that, because they're picking up on areas of unrest within the workforce. So there's a big piece around availability of personal protection equipment and how people can be socially distanced from each other and still work in plant. And the other big one is around staff availability, because you have a lot of people going off sick, you've got a lot of people social isolating, where they've got family members who have the virus but they themselves maybe don't have, but the rules are if that's the case you've got to go home and self-isolate. So in those sort of situations, you know, particularly in larger plants, again, you've got a lot of the workforce potentially going off sick, and that means that production has to be scaled back to a certain extent if you can't replace those workers quickly. So that's another kind of big area, and you're seeing that on an unskilled level and a skilled level. So you're also, because within a processing business, you'll have food quality managers, food safety managers, technical managers. Now, those people actually, again, even before coronavirus, there was a big restriction around the amount of people available in the industry in those areas. If those people then go sick, are there people sufficiently qualified to step into their shoes? And in some cases, not. And that has a big implication in terms of whether you can sign off products effectively in terms of food quality, whether you can keep on top of food safety issues. So again, I think what we're seeing is there are some moves afoot to look at people that have been laid off in the food service sector that maybe were heads of food service businesses, cafes and things like that, that have a knowledge of food safety already. Could they be transferred on a temporary basis into a production environment to maybe kind of look at and oversee food safety issues if there's an issue with shortage of personnel in those areas? So yeah, so those are kind of some of the areas that are ongoing.
To put this into perspective, is there a risk of food production from the manufacturing side of the industry? Could it come to a halt?
It doesn't look that serious at this point. You are seeing individual manufacturers struggling, others less so. Obviously, manufacturers that were predominantly supplying food service as well, they've been hit very hard because a lot of their business has kind of disappeared, and they're trying to look at how they transfer that over to maybe supplying retail or direct supply to consumers. But at this stage, from everything we're hearing, the crisis point isn't reached until the key 20% of workforce off-site for various reasons, sickness and self-isolation comes into effect. And then there are certain government plans in place that kind of would address that. At this stage, we're, as far as I can hear, we're nowhere near that kind of figure of 20%. In some cases, you are seeing 10%, 15%, but we haven't reached that threshold point. And I don't think, if you look at staff churn, it would ever kind of get to that point. But I think that's overall production force. In terms of individual managers, technical managers, food safety managers, I think that could be more of an issue for individual businesses, depending on how long they're off for, because that could really slow down production and potentially kind of stop production of certain foods in terms of getting them out the door.
Food and drink manufacturers are extremely good at forward planning and looking ahead to ensure their survival and productivity. So what threats is the sector focusing on, you know, not now in the immediate future, but after coronavirus or kind of towards the end of lockdown?
So the issues that you're looking ahead to kind of look at things like Brexit. Obviously, Brexit's another huge thing that's coming down the line. Clearly, obviously, on the one hand, the UK effectively left the EU at the beginning of this year. But of course, we're now in a transition period, and that transition period will remain in effect until the end of the year. So the full effect of Brexit, in terms of what it means in terms of how customs will operate, and supply and imports and exports will operate, won't be felt until the beginning of next year. So now, obviously, in that instance, the industry has been, you know, it's had time to plan a little bit more, but there will still obviously be, I think, some level of disruption associated with that. So we are kind of looking sort of mid to short term at that on the horizon. And I think some of the other challenges that may well face the industry will be the ongoing labour availability issue, because coronavirus or no coronavirus, I think that remains a key issue, both for skilled and unskilled staff. That's very important to stress, because most people think of it in terms of seasonal or unskilled workers. It's a problem in both areas. And then I think on a broader level, in order to compete on the international stage post-Brexit, the UK food industry has a particular challenge around industrialisation, automation and investment in that. And that, in a sense, goes hand in hand with lack of labour availability, because it is a way to address that by increasing automation. But then alongside that, you need a skilled workforce that can manage and maintain the machines, the robots, and the technology that you introduce on a plant level. And so you are still going to need people in that area. And the food industry historically has a bad, as I said earlier, has a bad image, and maybe isn't as glamorous as, say, aerospace or areas like this. And so a lot of those industries tend to kind of suck high-tech workers. So that's going to be an ongoing challenge for the industry, especially post-Brexit, where you are looking to compete on the international stage with countries that are more automated in food.
Now, we talked about migrant labour and the impact that Brexit is going to have on harvesting. The UK government's been talking a lot about a land army, so mobilising a lot of UK people into the fields. How important is that sort of movement to UK food security right now?
I think it will help, and you are seeing an uplift, and you are seeing an uplift in people on a domestic level that are looking to kind of provide support. But I think the numbers you're talking about on the labour side are quite substantial. My hunch, my feel at this stage is that any land army would not completely plug the gap. You need support from additional workers. And as I say, there are initiatives to fly workers in from Poland. It may be we'll have to look at other countries to do that. But in essence, what's ironic about this is, again, as we've said a couple of times, this has been an ongoing issue that's now exacerbated by coronavirus. And it's been an ongoing issue that's never really been properly addressed. And now we're having to address it. It's absolutely crucial that we address this issue of where these workers are going to come from. So, I mean, positively, ultimately, hopefully, we come out on the other side and you know, we will have addressed it and it will have pushed the food industry through to the next level. The challenge, of course, is that if you get a lot of cheaper imports coming in post-Brexit from other countries, then that could hit the domestic supply, particularly fresh produce and again, meat and things like that, quite hard. And again, you need to look at how you address that in terms of supporting domestic production. I think that's a key that the government needs to kind of focus on as well.
Yeah, and domestic production is quite an interesting one, because overall the UK can't really feed itself, kind of. We can't produce enough food to feed the residents of the UK without imports.
No, that's right. That's absolutely right. So if you look at pork, for example, just to, you know, plucking one category out of the air, at that stage you're looking at probably somewhere between 40-50% UK reliant imports. With, you know, the UK is reliant on almost half its total pork consumption coming from imports, and that's just kind of one example. And of course, you see a lot of fresh produce coming in from overseas. You see things like, as you said, tinned tomatoes. A lot of those are supplied in from Italy. So again, that there are a lot of areas in which the UK could be a lot more self-sufficient. There is a caveat there, of course, which is that in some areas, UK consumers don't want to buy the sort of produce that people in the UK would produce and supply. So that's a challenge. And they're more interested in supplying that's coming from overseas, the type of food that comes in from overseas. So again, there is a challenge around that. And of course, in some areas, the UK climate is just not suited to produce some types of products as well. So you need to kind of factor that in when you talk about, you know, domestic food security. But provided you allow for that, yes, we could, I think in this country, we could do a lot more to support and invest in our farming industry and in domestic producers to ramp up supply and replace imports.
Rod Addy, editor of Food Manufacturer Magazine, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Nick.
From the production line to supermarket shelves, which is where many of the goods made by manufacturers are destined, Ronan Hegarty is the news editor at grocery industry bible The Grocer. Ronan, thank you for taking time out in what must be a very busy time for you reporting on the food retail sector. Let's just dive straight on in. There's been a lot of focus on supermarkets since the outbreak, for obvious reasons, but how have working practices changed, especially within the Big Four?
I think the biggest change, Nick, is that it's the social distancing in the last few weeks that has really changed that how supermarkets operate. The big queues that we see now around car parks and stuff like that seem to be working very well. People seem to be quite taking to the new guidelines well once when they're in the queue, but not necessarily quite so well in the store. I think sometimes there's a little bit of tension in the stores where people are passing each other in aisles and stuff like that. I think some supermarkets are doing it better than others in terms of one-way systems and better marking, clear markings for keeping those sort of 2 meter distances. And then, of course, you've got a lot of the new sneeze screens all over the place, which do create a very different vibe within the supermarket itself.
I mean, it's been quite a change for everyone. Many businesses across the UK, especially the hospitality sector and other what the government's calling non-essential businesses, have struggled during the pandemic. Obviously, supermarkets are essential at this time. They seem to be winning almost, to put that into, you know, hopefully not a crude sense, but what do the figures look like?
It is absolutely, it seems a bit crude talking about the winners, but there's no doubt that effectively a handful of large grocery retailers are doing extraordinarily well in the last few weeks. In fact, March, I think, was the biggest month in grocery sales since records began. They've seen really 20.6% increase in sales over the sort of 4 weeks to sort of 21st of March. It's unprecedented, really. We saw a lot of that with the panic buying, and it's also sort of leveled out a bit more as well. But as we've seen, obviously, the fall off in restaurants, pubs and that, then people are obviously having to replace those meals somewhere. And again, it's the supermarkets that are the places people are going.
Yeah, and have supermarkets been responsible? Have their advertising and approaches changed so, you know, not to attract consumers in the wrong way, but in a responsible way?
I think they have. I think for a number of reasons. I think as well to try and ensure continuity of supply. I think that's the main focus right now. It's not necessarily trying to compete against each other. they know there's a lot of business going around and they'll probably all get their fair shares. So we're not seeing sort of lots of cutthroat pricing or anything like that. A lot of them have dropped promotions because they don't want, again, any undue spikes in supply sort of thing. And of course, we've seen them limiting the amounts of certain products people can buy at times to get their fair share. Thankfully now, for most people, those now limits are being lifted, and it's only now very few items in stores that people are still restricted on.
Yeah, you talk about taking the promotions away and, you know, not slashing prices. Have prices had to increase in recent days?
We're not seeing it massively just yet. We've been keeping an eye on it in the last few weeks to see if there's been major spikes. I think a few products here and there certainly are going up. I think in terms of supply and demand for ingredients and things like that are definitely pushing the prices up on a few things, but not to a huge extent. I think in the last sort of few weeks it's been relatively steady. I mean, we may see that sort of coming as a longer term trend in the months ahead, but at the moment it's not pushing up too much.
And what is interesting from an outsider's perspective, such as mine, is a few of the supermarkets, especially the major multiples, have given staff bonuses in a relatively, you know, what is often criticized or called an underpaid sector. How out of the ordinary is this?
It is pretty much out of the ordinary. We see them get bonuses annually, perhaps relating to sales performances and things like that. But these are unprecedented rewards and, you know, quite rightly deserved. I think you're right in that we haven't really thought about the people that stock our supermarkets and run our convenience stores as sort of really respected jobs in the past sort of thing. And now that we're all in this lockdown period, we've seen how important a job that is to keep the country's food and drink supply and keep our food in people's homes. So it's become a much more important job than it ever was before, and these people are finally maybe getting recognized as the sort of heroes and the heroic job they do. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, a lot of these people who work in supermarkets, they might be people that are part-time, they might be people that are sort of coming back to work after having families, they might be people sort of in the older category who are sort of looking to just do a few hours every week and stuff like that. They might be students who are topping up their grant money and stuff like that. So it's a real mixture of people sort of thing, and for them to be rewarded in this way is really, really important.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think we should use the term lightly when we call them essential key workers, because they are, and a lot of them are handling it in a very professional way, which is, you know, great to see, obviously, for consumers. We've talked a little bit about the multiples, kind of, you know, lots of customers going there, but they must be having some struggles of their own. What sort of struggles are the retailers facing?
I think it's definitely around availability. You can't guarantee the availability that they once would have had, where they had 20, 30 different varieties of certain lines that, you know, people could come and choose from. We're still seeing shortages on things like pasta, household cleaning products, particularly anything with strong anti-bac chemicals in them. It's interesting that certain products that maybe have a more environmentally friendly vibe about them, but not the strong chemicals, are still very much on the shelves, while the harsher chemicals on some products are still completely cleared from stores at the moment. People obviously are very concerned and making sure they get their house as clean as possible. But we're seeing some trouble with that. I think also that what they're doing really to do that is suppliers are focusing on core lines and pack sizes. They've all had to reduce the amount of products they're selling in terms of different varieties of pack sizes, flavors, varieties and stuff like that, because they want to make sure that everyone's getting enough essential items in the store.
Yeah, so a lot of supermarkets have cut SKUs to kind of keep up with the demand, essentials, as you've just said. But we know how hard manufacturers and businesses that sell into supermarkets work to get their products on that coveted shelf. How likely is it that the cut SKUs will be reinstated?
I think a lot of them will. It maybe won't be all of them, certainly. And I think retailers will certainly use this as an opportunity to see maybe what products are absolutely important to them. And if there's products that in this current crisis, and particularly over those sort of last 4 weeks of sort of panic buying, stockpiling that we saw in the first few weeks of March, and if products there that didn't sell even then, they might have a job staying on shelves. But I think ultimately the difference between the big four retailers and the discounters is always going to be choice. And so they will want to make sure that they have enough choice on the shelves to track consumers when all this dies down, when it all sort of gets back to any kind of normality.
pubs, bars, restaurants all closed, a big source of alcohol sales in the UK. What's happening in the supermarkets in terms of alcohol? We've seen pictures in the national press of wine and beer shelves being stripped bare.
Yes, it's really interesting to see that, particularly when that lockdown around the pub closures and the hospitality sector shutting down, that the supermarkets and convenience stores and off licenses obviously were the next to be hit in terms of panic buying, stockpiling, and you know, some bizarre pictures of beer shelves completely stripped except for Corona. But we've seen we saw again in the first 3 weeks of March, I think 160 million extra sales of alcohol. People clearly, if they're going to be locked in, they're going to want to enjoy themselves. It's become, you know, quite an essential really for people that, you know, they're getting through, they're still working or they're not working, and it's quite a stressful time being locked down with family and maybe locked down alone. So, you know, a few drinks here and there are clearly very, very important to people.
Talking about essentials, William Reid's Low to No Bev show, which focuses on the rising trend of low and no alcohol drinks. It has been moved, which has been widely publicised, to the 28th of September. But I'm kind of interested to know, what has the coronavirus pandemic done to the category, considering supermarkets have been cutting SKUs?
Although I've seen that some people are still launching new products into that category, because I think people do see there is a long-term future in it. I would imagine that supermarkets are not cutting SKUs as much in alcohol and in low and no. I think it's primarily around more the core grocery lines that are being cut. So it's more about making sure, trying to get as much stock in the stores as possible for, in terms of the alcohol and the no and low. And definitely that we've seen a big spike in the low and no before the lockdown happened. I think supermarkets showed that there was an 18% increase again in those few weeks, the 12 weeks to 21st of March. Sales were 31.3 million. So very, very healthy. And I think some people are looking to potentially, while they're in this lockdown, looking around issues like fitness and health and stuff like that. So that is another factor that people are balancing.
Ronan, it's been great chatting with you. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you, Nick.
Now, the retailers haven't been hit by the lockdown in the same way as the eating out market has. Thousands of pubs, clubs, bars and restaurants, including many of the UK's favourite casual dining brands, have mostly all closed their doors. Here to explain what this means about the future of the category is editor of MCA, James Halliwell. James, thank you for joining me.
Hello, Nick.
First of all, what does the once booming casual dining sector now look like?
It looks horrendous. Because like everyone else, it's effectively on lockdown. And I think the thing to remember is that it was booming a few years ago. More recently, in the last couple of years, it was really struggling thanks to a combination of pressures like rising wages, rents, business rates, and an oversaturated market. So really, for the last couple of years, we've watched operators struggle and go under as a result. But what I think is it puts the enormity of this situation into perspective if you consider that those problems seem relatively trivial by comparison with this one. So it's a pretty simple answer. It's shut. It's stuck in an impasse. There are some exceptions among the chains, Pizza Hut and Domino's. And in the last couple of days, KFC, Pret and Burger King have started to gradually open up a handful of stores, but it's nowhere near back to normal. And I doubt it will be for months.
No, and that's probably not going to bring in enough money, I'm guessing, as well. It's they're doing a lot of it for NHS and to support the local.
Yeah, it's a trickle.
How have the businesses out there that are in a strong position going into this, how are they protecting themselves to make sure that they can come out of it in as good a position as possible?
I think there are two sort of main ways. First of all, the majority have tried to take advantage of what's on offer in the way of financial support by the government, and a minority have rejigged their models and ranging, like Leon, which has been converting some outlets into makeshift grocery stores, but it is a minority. And others, like the restaurant group, which has several chains, including Wagamama, Brunning & Price, but also, I mean, it's got about 600 sites overall, but it's also got struggling chains like Frankie & Benny's and Chiquito. It's put Chiquito into administration, which to me feels like a pragmatic acceptance of the inevitable and something that enhances the clarity of the business going forward, which is a form of protection in a sense. The trouble for everyone, whether they were struggling before or whether they were flying before, is that for obvious reasons, they're all dependent on customers visiting them, but customers aren't allowed to right now. So the measures you can take to protect yourself from that fundamental challenge are limited.
we talked a little bit about the government support there and how, you know, some companies have been able to use it to as great effect as possible. But is what's out there at the moment enough? Because, you know, the rateable value of 51k, you know, people aren't eligible for grants and they're almost being penalised for being successful in certain circumstances.
The measures that were released, for many, they are a help. And for some, they brought instant relief. But I don't think it's working out as planned. You mentioned the 51k there, which is obviously, like you said, just made it unusable. For many, the job retention scheme is a big one. It effectively looked like a big help, but presumably they didn't anticipate it to be as popular as it is. From what I gather, it's hugely oversubscribed. It's around 9 million people and rising, according to the HMRC yesterday. And that obviously presents a problem, because if that unexpected popularity means it can't be extended, then mass redundancy is going to follow. And it's probably too simplistic, but the worst case scenario, just going on the HMR figure, is effectively 9 million people out of work overnight. So I imagine they will extend the JRS, but with new thresholds for those who can access it, which is probably what they wish they'd done in the first place, sort of restrict it to sectors forced to close like hospitality. But a lot of people are in the same boat, and I'm not surprised that some of the details were overlooked under the circumstances. I mean, if we're asking, you know, is it enough? I think Rishi Sunak is an inexperienced chancellor. He's been thrust into an extremely challenging financial situation for the country as a whole. And this is complex policy rolled out at rapid speed under extraordinary circumstances. So expecting it to be perfect from the word go is a big ask. So I'm sure they're doing nothing else but looking how to make it better. And they are being lobbied hard by the hospitality industry to show them what they need to do.
Of course, some of the headlines recently, 2 million jobs will be lost by the end of this potentially. You know, the UK is going to go into one of the worst recessions for 300 years potentially. The hospitality sector is one of the biggest employers in the UK, and we need those jobs to help the economy return, don't we? So it's surprising that, you know, there isn't much more focus than there has been at the moment.
Well, I think what's probably happened is that it's a few weeks ago now that they unveiled it, and it was supposed to last for 3 months and then to extend that if necessary. We can't face a situation as an economy as a whole where you suddenly have 2 million people jumping on the what is already a creaking benefit system. And that's obviously not the only contribution to GDP that comes from people spending in lively venues, whether they're pubs or restaurants. Yeah. So I think thanks to the efforts of people like UK Hospitality, they will just keep drilling that message into the government. And I'd be surprised if the government didn't already know what they need to do. They're just fighting fires all over the shop. Hopefully they'll listen and come through with something helpful and constructive that supports the industry to help it return to an approximation of what it once was.
Let's not forget the fact that there are organisations out there like UK Hospitality that have lobbied exceptionally hard to get what the industry needs right now and to put it in a safer position. That should definitely be commended. Just paint us a picture, just briefly, how hard has the sector been hit? I know we can't see into the future and we shouldn't speculate because we don't know what's going to happen. But in the current circumstances, what could the sector look like going out of lockdown?
How hard has it been hit? I don't really see how it could have been hit any harder. It's effectively been knocked out cold. Many operators are not going to get up again. I mean, some will, but put it this way, it's been hit so hard it's going to reemerge badly disfigured, and it's going to be very unsteady on its feet for a long time.
What about the people? How many jobs do you think the industry can bring back into the sector once lockdown's over and once we can live life without social distancing?
I guess without being too simplistic, some operators will return and some won't. I mean, there are so many elements that feed into that possibility. Some operators will have sympathetic landlords, for example, and some won't. Some will probably have quite solid cash reserves or debt facilities they can tap into, although I imagine they're coming under pressure. And I feel like some might get ground down by the whole experience and end up being forced to go under.
Yeah.
I mean, if we talk about the social distancing, even if the government relaxed every single restriction on social distancing and mass gatherings tomorrow, which of course they're not going to do, but even if they did, for operators, it's been enough of a fallow period so far that it's not a case of just flicking a switch and everything being fine again. You know, supply chains have stopped. Employees, you know, have whether they've been furloughed or made redundant, you know, if they're furloughed, they might have had to go and find another job that they might find they prefer doing. And also, you know, how it strikes me that how many will actually there will surely be a percentage who won't actually want to. You know, every day it's drilled into us that we mustn't socialise or mingle with anyone else, or else risk becoming infected. So it's hard to imagine the appeal of working a busy shift in a pub or in a restaurant, certainly in the early days of any restrictions being lifted.
Yeah, the nation's psyche's been changed, hasn't it, in such a short space of time?
Yeah, I do. I think that, and I mean, I think what we're going to see is a slow reemergence by the bigger and more robust brands operating out of limited sites with a limited offer and limited staff, which is what we're seeing with Pret, KFC, and Burger King. I mean, you're talking about 10 sites here, 15 sites there. And when you talk about the national psyche, I think that's a really important point, because we've got to hope that consumers haven't been left so scarred by this, by the whole experience, that they're simply uncomfortable being out and about, or they've been left so cash poor that they have to cut back on, you know, the fun things like eating and drinking out. I mean, I think obviously some people are going to rush out as soon as possible and straight down to the pub or out for a McDonald's or something, but many won't. And I think ultimately it's going to take time for every part of that casual dining ecosystem to get back to the way it was before, if indeed it ever does.
Yeah. Now, I spend most of my time writing about pubs on the Morning Advertiser, so I know how a lot of the businesses there have diversified and, you know, started takeaways and deliveries to support the local community and the NHS. What about the casual dining brands? Maybe it's the bigger ones, maybe there's the smaller ones. What have they been doing to diversify in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, initially it was interesting to watch, because you had people like McDonald's closing. It was sort of a little bit at a time. They sort of started closing seating areas, then moving to delivery or collection only. But that didn't last for very long. And from the operators I spoke to, the official reason anyway was the safety of its customers and its staff. But like you said, some have reopened, you know, predominantly in support of the NHS. So Pret reopening 10 sites. If you're a member of the public, you're welcome. But I think what they're hoping to do is to feed and supply NHS workers and healthcare workers more than the general public. You had other examples of pivoting to a different range and offer. Leon converting into little grocery stores, but they're definitely isolated. You've seen other little things like operators like Wagamama doing, you know, offering cooking from home content online. But again, that feels more like just staying in touch with the fan base than developing an alternative revenue stream. Ultimately, so the diversification is happening, but it's on a very small scale. And I think for casual dining overall, the overarching decision has been a pragmatic one, which is just to shut up shop, hunker down, utilize the support and offer from the government, and hope to start up again once the stringent lockdown measures begin to relax.
Yeah, so there's, you could be quite confident in saying there's probably no company out there that is, you know, in quotation marks, winning, because nobody's winning right now, but succeeding in the current situation.
No, I don't think there's anybody winning out there. There's probably people winning on the PR front. Certainly Leon was out on its own doing what it did to begin with, and I think it got a tremendously sort of positive reception by everyone for doing what it was doing. But I don't think overall there are no winners, and however this plays out, there are unlikely to be. I mean, I guess if there are anybody who's probably seen a sort of uptick in regularity, I suppose, is the third party delivery guys like, yeah, Deliveroo, for example. We see they've signed deals with vendors they may not have struck a deal with before, like Morrisons and M&S. And I imagine that will continue, because clearly even the likes of Tesco can't keep up with demand for online delivery from a logistic perspective. So they need assistance in that respect. But even if when you weigh that against the business that Deliveroo will have lost from chains like Wagamama, which was always great for Deliveroo, they're shut. So I don't know the exact figures or details. But whatever new business someone like Deliveroo is picking up, I imagine they're still down overall. I mean, the other guys, you look at Uber Eats, did a huge chunk of its overall business delivering McDonald's. Right now, it's not going to be delivering a single nugget. And if I was looking at the Uber Eats app the other day, and I can see they're delivering from my local petrol station stuff like wine and spirits. Yeah. So it's possible that they are keeping revenue streams fairly constant if they can secure a higher margin from more premium products. I don't know, but it feels unlikely that they're up on the deal. Just Eat are in a slightly different position, because they have much wider geographical coverage than the other two, and it's MO is to work with smaller independent operators who, by and large, have stayed open much more than the chains. They will shut down, but the little indies who have always made up most of Just Eat's business, I think many of them are still offering. And I think that deliveries are also increasing among consumers. So MCA Insight data showed them up 25% since the lockdown began. So that, you know, not in terms of sales, but just in terms of orders placed. And I think in a few months we'll see some numbers and results coming out from them, which may reveal more. But I just sense that given the blanket nature of the shutdown, I doubt things are better for any of them than they were before.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about delivery, and we've just talked about the national psyche as well. If more people are taking deliveries from venues to their home, do you think that could then have a knock-on effect when lockdown is lifted, when we can live life as normally as we used to? Do you think people would be more inclined then to go, oh, do you know what? I enjoyed my takeaways at home from the Indian down the road. I'm gonna get my takeaways from there now rather than going out.
Yeah, and they enjoy their takeaways at home from the big chains like Wagamama again, or any of them really. And I think that actually taps into one of the fears that already existed before this, which was if people realize that they can just open the phone and just tap out an order and sit back and wait for someone else to deliver it, and they can enjoy the same food that they can enjoy at the restaurant, what's the point of going out? Which is why, you know, there was much more focus starting to be placed on the other aspects of going out, you know, the fun and the entertainment and the theatre and of dining, eating and drinking out rather than just staying in. But I'd always felt that once people realised how simple and easy an app like Deliveroo is to use and what it, you know, the convenience and everything it can bring you, then it becomes part of their eating and drinking out budget. So I don't doubt for one second that even when this does return to normal, you'll see more regularity in using the likes of Deliveroo, Uber Eats and Just Eat.
Now, you speak with a lot of the bosses at the head of these big casual dining chains. What are they talking about? What is their focus at the moment?
There's one thing they're talking about at the moment, and that's survival. And then it will be recovery, and obviously everyone will also be planning how they can recover. But, you know, similar to the government a few weeks ago, planning at the moment is beset by difficulties from all sorts of angles. No one knows how long this is going to last for, what the sector is going to be like in terms of operators being able to reopen, what that customer appetite or desire is to even go out, or what the state of their wallets are going to be like once this is finished. So I think right now the recovery, and I also think that right now they're not necessarily at a stage where that's the priority, because right now I think everyone is just in survival mode and trying to hang in there.
James, you've given us a very clear picture. Thank you so much for your time. That's James Halliwell, editor of MCA.
Thanks, Nick.
And finally, we're going to spend a little time focusing on the great British institute that is the pub. Like all hospitality businesses, the pub trade has been hit hard during the current crisis. On hand to talk through the latest developments is the Morning Advertiser editor, Ed Beddington. Ed, thanks for taking some time out today.
Not a problem, Nick.
First of all, what does the pub trade look like right now?
Pretty much like everyone at the moment, it's in shutdown, it's lockdown. Primarily, most places are closed. We do have some that are continuing to do a degree of trade in terms of takeaway and delivery services. Some are setting up as kitchens to help fund or provide meals for key workers and children, things like that, which is good to see. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty decimated generally across the piece.
Prior to the lockdown and shortly after, there was a lot of uncertainty, there was a lot of unknowns as well. There's been a lot of information out there since that period. Tell us how far the sector has come since the pandemic shut pub trade down.
It's come a long way. I think obviously we were in massively uncharted waters when the orders came. We had that sort of rather dodgy sort of few weeks in which a sort of stuttered start or stop kind of thing, when people were advised not to go to pubs but not told that they shouldn't, which caused a lot of headaches for people as they found trade just sort of dropped off a cliff, but they weren't being told to shut and they weren't being given some explicit instructions or support. since then, we've obviously had the full closure and the various support that the government has offered, which has been very welcome. Some would say it's not gone far enough. Some would say it's acceptable. It will do the deal. I think it's everyone's personal circumstances are different. And obviously, there are some businesses that unfortunately have been left out of that support due to the ridiculous rating system that we have in place, which is a real blow, because they tend to be the more successful and professional operations out there, and they're sort of left high and dry. But I think the industry has rallied brilliantly. I think those that have stepped up, you know, they've done the right thing. They've shut down, they've furloughed their staff, they've put in place measures to keep the businesses ticking over. It's been fantastic to see. I think there's a lot of heroes out there in the trade that hopefully will get a moment in the spotlight at some point, but they've done a brilliant job in a very confusing situation and a very worrying and anxious situation as well. That anxiety still goes on. We don't know how long this is going to last. People are hoping for a shorter time than longer, but we don't know. And that anxiety is still out there. But in generally, I think the pub trade has been sterling in the way they've stepped up to the challenge and risen to the situation as they found it.
And there's a lot of pubs out there that have been diversifying and making the best out of a bad situation. Lots are trading still with takeaways and deliveries. How have their supply chains had to change in response to that activity?
You're right. There's been some brilliant examples of businesses. I mean, this shows at its heart why the pubs are so great, because you know they're survivors. They evolve. They adapt. They play a really important role within their communities. So I know some pubs have been keeping people fed and watered. You know, they're going out to elderly people who can't get out and delivering food direct to them, which is wonderful to see. And I think it is that great entrepreneurship that you see within the pub sector that people will find ways to evolve and adapt. And even in unprecedented and challenging situations like we have, it's impressive to see the way that they are evolving. And you've mentioned, you know, the takeaways and deliveries, but you've also got pubs that are running as food banks. You've got pubs that are setting up sort of grocery shops, allowing people to get sort of essential products, things like that. And it just reinforces that community aspect of the pub and the role that it plays and why it's such a vital resource for our communities around the country.
Now, food is an obvious choice and sometimes easy choice to launch takeaway and delivery services with, but how are operators able to make drinks work in these scenarios?
Well, I think there's been some confusion on this, because certain authorities, local authorities and police forces around the country have taken different approaches. But essentially, the government said that off licences were to remain open, that they were essential services. So pubs have been able to tap into that if they have the right licences. If they're a licensed to sell off the premises, then they can do this, and many have. So, and we've seen some great innovations within that. It's not just a case of turning up with a growler and filling up with beer. We're seeing pubs doing fantastic jobs on wine sales, even cocktails, you know, simple basic cocktail mixes that they're able to package up and sell as off sales. It's been fantastic to see. And I think again it's not just drink sales in isolation. You know, this is part of the broader mix of food and drink and providing those services still to people in difficult circumstances. But it's been fantastic to see.
Looking to an unknown future, because as you mentioned earlier, we don't know when this is all going to end and when things could get back to normal. When pubs can reopen, it's not just as simple as open up the doors and trading as normal again, is it? What do we need to consider when looking at this?
No, that's it. And I think we need a plan in place from government to help our readers and operators to prepare, because you're right, it isn't just a case of flinging the doors open and the customers flooding in. You know, you've got to get back up and running. These things take time. You know, you've got to set up your cellars. You can't just chuck a cask in there and start pulling it straight away. You've got to let it settle. You've got to do all the kind of cellar work that you would do. And a lot of this is, again, we've talked about unprecedented. This is pretty much unprecedented. It's like opening a pub a new pub, really. These are established businesses that have probably never shut down like this. And they're having to sort of start from scratch. So, you know, they've got to make sure their equipment's all working. So their cellar equipment, they've got to get it to the right temperatures. You know, they've got to make sure that their kitchens are ready to get up and running. So they've got to be clean. They've got to be up to the right hygiene standards. And they've also got to ensure that they've got food and drink supplies coming in. And don't forget, you know, these businesses have been shut for several months at the moment. So they won't have any supplies in the main. So they won't have been dealing with their suppliers. So, you know, they need to be thinking about that. They need to be having conversations with their suppliers. Some will have not been able to afford to pay their suppliers. Their suppliers will have been struggling throughout this period as well. So they need to make sure that, A, their suppliers are still in business and able to meet those demands, and that they've got any sort of debt or any situation with that. They need to ensure that they're in a position to agree some kind of terms to pay those bills and help those guys survive. But there's a lot to do. Your staff need to be up to speed. You've got to make sure that they're ready, they're available, that they've got the right training in place to deal with the resurgence in operations when hopefully, touch wood, before too long we get the green light to open those doors again.
Indeed. Ed, thank you very much for your time.
No problem.
That's all we have time for, and I hope we've given you a better understanding of how the food and drink sector has been affected by the coronavirus lockdown. Thank you for listening to this special William Reid Food and Drink podcast.